All right, well, you can hear me, yeah? Okay. The backdrop to this paper is the War of the Spanish Succession, the first of the major 18th century wars that Britain was engaged in. But the real detail of this paper will be about what I'm calling the paper war between Daniel Defoe and Henry Sacheverell, the domestic context of Britain's engagement with the War of the Spanish Succession was watched deeply by people throughout Europe because it mattered. The Whigs and the Tories, the two major political parties of the time, had very different attitudes towards the prosecution of the war and indeed the conclusion of a peace treaty. The Whigs in the early 18th century were the war party. The Tories, to a large degree, were the party of peace, working towards trying to bring a rapid conclusion to the war. So the domestic ramifications of the battles between the Whigs and the Tories would have greater impact throughout Europe should one side or the other prevail. So when the Tory clergyman Henry Sacheverell was prosecuted for high crimes and misdemeanors in the spring of 1710, the rest of Europe was watching because this was seen to be a clear political trial in which the outcome, perhaps, of the war in Europe might be decided by the way in which the contest between Whigs and Tories would play out in this attempt by the Whig government of the day to prosecute a Tory clergyman. So on the second day, then, of the acclaimed trial of Dr. Henry Sacheverell, a young and ambitious Whig member of Parliament named Sir Robert Walpole made a vigorous case for the prosecution at the trial. Oh, actually, we've got our presentation. Here we go. There we are. Okay. Yes. Walpole made a vigorous case for the prosecution at the trial. Sacheverell stood accused by the Whig managers for his prosecution of denying the legitimacy of King William's glorious revolution of 1688, of denying the validity of the so-called Act of Toleration of 1689, which had given Protestant dissenters the legal right to worship without fear of prosecution, and of defaming the Queen's ministers in so doing. So before an audience of over 2,000 people at this trial, Walpole argued that Sacheverell's was no ordinary case of seditious libel. And this was these were the words he used to present his case against Sacheverell. The great licentiousness of the press in censoring and reflecting upon all parts of government have of late too just cause of offense. But when any pamphlets and common libels are matter of complaint, when none but mercenary scribblers in the hackney pens of a discontented party are employed to vent their malice, it is fit to leave them to the common course of the law and to the ordinary proceedings of the courts below. But, my lords, when the trumpet is sounded in Zion, when the pulpit takes up the cudgels, when the cause of the enemies of our government is the cause of God and of the church, when this bitter and poisonous pill is gilded over with the specious name of loyalty, and the people are taught, for their souls and conscience's sake, to swallow these pernicious doctrines, when, instead of sound religion, divinity, and morality, factious and seditious discourses are become the constant entertainments of some congregations, the commons cannot but think it high time to put a stop to this growing evil, and for the authority of the Parliament to interpose and exert itself in defense of the revolution, the present government, and the Protestant succession. Now, a few minutes later, Walpole would also describe Dr. Sacheverell as a seditious, discontented, hot-headed, ungifted, unedifying preacher who had no hopes of distinguishing himself in the world but by a matchless indiscretion. Now, Tory observers of Walpole's speech were horrified at this indiscreet invective, and many were convinced that Walpole himself had libeled in an ordained clergyman of the established church. So Walpole's speech and the reactions it engendered is perhaps one of the clearest examples of the close relationship between libel and politics in the age of Queen Anne. Now, Sacheverell's trial was so sensational because it involved the prosecution of a clergyman for things he had said during his sermons, a moment when a preacher is supposed to interpret biblical truth in the light of Orthodox doctrine. And this is indeed exactly what Sacheverell had claimed to have done. But his Whig prosecutors argued that he had neglected his sacred duty and had instead taken the occasion to issue a series of tendentious, wrong-headed, and indeed libelous opinions rather than preaching the Word of God. Several of the managers for the prosecution referred to Sacheverell's sermon as a libel in their speeches. Walpole's was only the most vociferous case in a united Whig front against the doctor's sermons. And indeed, the House of Commons complaint justifying Sacheverell's impeachment would declare his sermons to be malicious, scandalous, and seditious libels. Now, while Walpole's speech claimed that Sacheverell's case required the gravity of a parliamentary trial due to his station as a clergyman, the doctor was a trumpeter sounding in Zion and the preacher taking up the cudgels in his pulpit, as it were, there's also a sense in which Sacheverell's sermons and his public persona more generally were also scandalous because they appeared to be very similar to the work of those mercenary scribblers and the hackney pens that Walpole claimed to be such a minor nuisance when compared to the gravity of the doctor's pulpit fulminations. Now, Sacheverell's case bears a close resemblance to a prosecution that took place 7 years earlier, the conviction of the mercenary scribbler, Daniel Defoe, for publishing his parody of Dr. Sacheverell's early Oxford sermon, The Political Union, which had been delivered and published in 1702. Defoe's tract was entitled The Shortest Way with the Dissenters. Now, one might think that the only thing that Daniel Defoe and Henry Sacheverell shared was a mutual detestation for one another. And yet their public images were curiously intertwined throughout Queen Anne's reign. Above all, both Defoe and Sacheverell would become famous due to the fact that they were prosecuted for their writings. Defoe's conviction for seditious libel in 1703 and Sacheverell's for the same offense in 1710, I think, are worthy of sustained comparison, not least because both cases involved many of the same individuals on opposite sides of the political spectrum. Whereas Defoe was prosecuted for satirizing Sacheverell, he would delight in observing the doctor's prosecution 7 years later. And Sacheverell would defend himself during his trial by referring to Defoe's writings as examples of the kind of seditious libels that he thought would put the Church of England in danger, and hence that had been the real target, rather than the Queen's ministers, for condemnation in his notorious St. Paul's Cathedral sermon on the 5th of November in 1709. Now, the Tories who pressed hard for Defoe's conviction in 1703 can be found defending Sacheverell vigorously during his trial in 1710. The Earl of Nottingham as Secretary of State and Sir Simon Harcourt as Solicitor General were both responsible for Defoe's prosecution and punishment in 1703, but Harcourt played the lead role as Sacheverell's legal counsel during his trial. And Nottingham came close to scuppering the whole proceedings by asking whether a conviction for libel required the prosecution to identify the precise words thought to be criminal in their indictment. In other words, you have the same players operating in the prosecution of Defoe in 1703 and the prosecution of Sacheverell in 1710. But more importantly, comparing Defoe's and Sacheverell's cases illuminates the structures of public formation in early 18th century England. The management and manipulation of public opinion was an increasingly important aspect of political life, and indeed political success, in post-revolutionary England. And I think this accounts for the intense interest aroused by both cases, as well as the high stakes for both Whigs and Tories in navigating the controversies aroused by these prosecutions successfully. One of the most obvious points of correspondence is that personality figured prominently in the prosecution of both Daniel Defoe and Henry Sacheverell. While the charge of seditious libel was meant to focus solely on the words written and the thoughts expressed by the accused, the fact that their prosecution was made so publicly meant that the author almost immediately became much more well-renowned as a result of the prosecution than he had been before it had begun. This was particularly so for Daniel Defoe. He was hardly known at all in the public sphere before he had published The Shortest Way. The controversy provoked by this anonymously published work would generate an intense interest in the man who had written the book. Once it had been determined that the author was not a high churchman, but rather Defoe, writing as a satirist, Nottingham would issue a £50 reward for information leading to the apprehension of one Daniel Defoe, or F-O-O-E. I think it's curious that his name is spelled in a variety of different ways at this stage. There was no standardization of his identity or even his name at this point. And Nottingham published a description of Defoe's person for the readers of the London Gazette. It read as follows. He is a middle-sized, spare man, about 40 years old, of a brown complexion and a dark brown colored hair. He wears a wig, a hooked nose, a sharp chin, gray eyes, and a large mole near his mouth. Was born in London and for many years was a hose factor in Freeman's Yard in Cornhill, and is now the owner of a brick and pantile works near Tilbury Fort in Essex. So, before his prosecution, very few people knew anything about Daniel Defoe. Narcissus Luttrell's first mention of him was as one Lafo, but now he was known as Daniel Foe, comma, author. Just months after he stood in the pillory, Defoe's first edition of his collected works had been published. A second volume of his works would appear again in 1705, and his portrait would be affixed to the frontispiece to his long poem, Jure Divino, in 1706. Now, although he never quite managed to throw off his reputation as being nothing more than a hackney scribbler, Defoe's post-pillory career would turn out to be much more illustrious than it had been prior to his prosecution. Now, perhaps the greatest of Defoe's achievements was to attract, through the shortest way controversies and his subsequent prosecution, the attention and the patronage of Robert Harley, a wily politician who would soon assume the role of Secretary of State, and ultimately, in the wake of Sacheverell's prosecution, the top job of Lord Treasurer. Harley's achievements as manager of the press are well known, particularly from the works of Alan Downey and more recently Alex Barber. Harley's patronage was undoubtedly crucial to Defoe's subsequent success, but it nevertheless remained true that after his time in the pillory, the author Defoe had become a recognized name in the literary public sphere, and his future works were eagerly awaited by a reading public, so much so that his booksellers could take in subscriptions in advance. In short, Defoe had become famous. He was a literary celebrity. And he had earned his fame through attacking Henry Sacheverell and thus provoking spectacular punishment in the pillory for his libel. So if the experience of being placed in the pillory for three rainy summer days in July was meant to teach Defoe a lesson that would encourage him to change his libelous ways and give up the pen for a more honest profession, then this punishment would fail terribly. Within less than a year, he returned to his Sacheverell baiting in a work entitled More Short Ways with the Dissenters, which was published in April of 1704. Now here, Defoe claimed that Sacheverell was the real author of The Shortest Way, though another was punished for it, and we see he has the face to let them know he is still of the same mind. He went on then to accuse Sacheverell of positive untruths, I am loath to say lies, he added, of which I'll prove you have this in one sermon, and here he is referring to Sacheverell's sermon, The Nature and Mischief of Prejudice and Partiality Stated, and he had debauched the pulpit with above 14 of these lies to the scandal of his ministerial function. And in a later tract, Defoe would take to name-calling, and he dubbed Sacheverell the Generalissimo of the Oxford Squadron, here referring to Oxford University's role as the incubator for high church sentiment and Tory politics. 2 years later, in Defoe's long poem, Jure Divino, Defoe would refer to Sacheverell as a passive priest with sword and pistol, who clouds his perjury with providence. Both of these clear references to Sacheverell's apparent hypocrisy in claiming to uphold the doctrine of passive obedience when he was secretly plotting a Jacobite restoration, or so Defoe would have it. I don't think Sacheverell was actually doing that, but that was a common sort of accusation by Whiggishly inclined authors to accuse Tories of plotting for a Jacobite restoration after to restore the Stuarts to the British throne. So after his trial, Sacheverell would indeed be protected by armed guards, and he would be threatened with violence by his enemies. And I think that's worth keeping in mind in terms of studying the paper wars of Queen Anne's reign, is that there was often the threat and often the reality of real violence behind these wars. Authors would get beat up. The Whig writer John Tutchin was severely beaten up by thugs hired by noblemen who had been offended by his writings. The threat of violence was often there. In fact, some authors would also threaten to beat one another up and such. And the Duke of Marlborough would write saying, "We must break the legs of these scribblers," and such. And Sacheverell himself too would be chased down by men with pistols. So there was under the veneer of this propaganda war the threat of a proper civil war. Time and time again, Defoe would accuse Sacheverell of wearing a mask and pretending to be more moderate with regard to the sincerity of his belief in the Protestant succession and toleration for Protestant dissent. And he would ironically thank the doctor for having revealed his true self in his most high-flying rhetorical excesses, which indeed occurred often enough to provide Defoe with many easy targets. This was the point of Defoe's second ironic satire aimed at the doctor, A Letter to Mr. Bissett, which was published in 1710, and as well in work he published in the journal The Review while Sacheverell's trial was underway. So despite the continued invective he delivered against the doctor throughout Queen Anne's reign, Defoe claimed not to be interested in libeling Sacheverell through personal attacks. Having experienced himself a personal renaissance through his experience of public persecution for his writings, Defoe warned against making a living martyr out of Sacheverell for his high church partisans. In the review, Defoe declared that, "I had rather see the crime punished than the man. I had rather see the wound cured than the hand that gave it cut off." Such warnings had little effect, though, as Sacheverell emerged from his trial as a triumphant living martyr, and his Tory supporters would mobilize all of the successful propaganda of royalist and Anglican martyrdom that had been central to Tory political identity since the regicide of King Charles I. Just as had been the case for Defoe with his conviction for seditious libel and his punishment by pillory, Sacheverell would emerge from his impeachment and conviction an even greater public hero and a champion for the high church cause. Even Defoe himself had trouble heeding his own warning against attacking Sacheverell's person. The political culture of the period was too fixated on personalities for Defoe to ignore Sacheverell's colorful persona in favor of abstract discussions of resistance theory, passive obedience, and religious toleration, which were the ostensible subject of debates between Whigs and Tories. Instead, Defoe opted for good old-fashioned character assassination, both in his public and his private writings. Just as Sacheverell's trial had begun, Defoe wrote to the Lieutenant General James Stanhope, one of the Whig managers for the doctor's prosecution, to provide him with details of the moral failings of this insolent priest, as he called Sacheverell. Defoe began by pointing out Sacheverell's well-known reputation for drunken excess. "I do not say there are members in your own house who have been drunk with him 100 times. Defoe claimed. "Even worse, he has drunk King James's health on his knees, and he passed along hearsay evidence of one Samuel Eberle of Birmingham, that Eberle had heard Sacheverell acclaim during King William's reign that the king would come to be dewitted, and that he, indeed, Sacheverell, hoped to see it." And by dewitted, he's referring then to the fate of Jan de Witt, who was the stadtholder in the United Provinces in the 1650s, still in a living memory here in the early 18th century, who had been assassinated, in fact, torn apart by a riotous crowd at the time. And so if Sacheverell had actually said something like that, that indeed would have been treasonous speech. Now, at the same time, Defoe committed to the same accusations to print, and they would appear in the 9th of March issue in 1710 of the Review. The accusation occasioned a great deal of further controversy, which would play out in the periodical press and the pamphlet literature. And although it could not be verified, it helped to provoke continued doubts as to the sincerity of Sacheverell's support for the Glorious Revolution and his loyalty to the Protestant and Hanoverian secession. As a countermeasure, then, Sacheverell's bookseller, Henry Clements, would offer to put on display at his bookshop an affidavit signed by several of Eberle's fellow Birminghamians, which denied that they had ever heard any such seditious discourses from Sacheverell. So the mutual antagonism between Defoe and Sacheverell was not an equal match, however, and Defoe always stood more to gain from attacking the doctor than vice versa. Sacheverell and the legal counsel for his defense at his trial never criticized Defoe by name. By 1710, he was most commonly referred to by the title of his periodical, The Review. As a professional writer, or as a hackney scribbler, Defoe had little interest to the public outside of his position as an author. He was most often known as Mr. Review, or perhaps the author of The Shortest Way with the Dissenters. In a broadside print published around the same time of Sacheverell's trial, an effigy of Defoe, which indeed looks nothing like him, would appear alongside equally indistinct and generic images of other periodical writers of the time. And we can see them here in this image, the three champions. Here you see this effigy of Defoe along with Isaac Bickerstaff, the eidolon for Richard Steele in the journal The Tatler, and The Observator, another Whig journal written at that time by the Scotsman George Ridpath. All three are identified as the British libelers, and their portraits are surrounded by images of a pillory, swords, halberds, and other weapons. You can see them all around there. Presumably a reference here to the Whig defense of resistance theory in the Sacheverell controversies. Now, the text below these generic effigies would ominously note that these periodical libelers have the pillory disgraced and may the gallows. Although Defoe had emerged from his experience in the pillory with greater fame and greater recognition for his talents as a writer and as a propagandist, the shame of his public punishment remained a smirch upon his reputation, so much so that his enemies continued to use it to disparage him. Swift would dismissively refer to Defoe in a pamphlet of 1709 as, "That fellow that was pilloried, I have forgot his name." While Joseph Addison advised Defoe to give up publishing libels and slander as he valued his ears. Another reference here to a common punishment for seditious libel, which was actually to cut off the ears of the libeler, as indeed had happened to William Prynne in the 1630s under Charles I. So this was surely a derisive reference to Defoe's attempt to associate himself with earlier 17th century martyrs to the tyranny and arbitrary government of Charles I, people like William Prynne or John Bastwick. He did this most explicitly in his defiant poem, A Hymn to the Pillory, which was published in 1703 and was composed and published while Defoe was awaiting punishment by pillory in Newgate Prison. Copies of this tract were hawked and sold to the crowds that came to see him standing in the pillory. Tory commentators like William Pittis were hardly impressed by Defoe's claim to associate himself with previous political martyrs. He has as little fancy for martyrdom as he has to call the lamented death of King Charles I so, and as I have been told, he offered to turn the current of his pen another way, might he have been excused some little ceremonies the law had obliged him to undergo so first, according to Pittis. Now, indeed, his suspicions were well placed, as Defoe would indeed go on to write for both the Whigs and the Tories, and he had indeed pleaded for a reprieve to Nottingham before his sentence. He even claimed that he could serve the government well as the commander of a cavalry troop in the war against France, which is really a remarkable idea that Defoe, the writer, was going to go and lead a group of cavalrymen off to fight in the war. But Defoe was, he was not short on hubris, we'll say that. He had immense confidence in his own abilities to do just about anything, even becoming leader of a cavalry troop. Pittis mocked Defoe's claim to stand in a long line of heroic pilloried martyrs, people like John Bastwick and William Pinn. "Insupportable impudence," he claimed. "How came Johnny Lilburn out of his list? he exclaimed. So it was common Tory strategy to deride Whigs by associating them with the regicide or leveler radicalism, and Defoe then would be an easy target of this criticism. John Lilburn was a famous leveler radical from the English Revolution, and so to associate Defoe with him then would be a way of besmirching his reputation. Defoe may have managed to turn his punishment for seditious libel into a career booster, but he would never be understood as a popular hero for either the Whigs, or still less the Tories, despite the fact that he would lend his services to supporting politicians from both sides of the partisan divide throughout his career. He gained fame in the sense of notoriety in his reincarnation as Mr. Review after his time in the pillory, but he failed to be seen as the martyr to tyrannical government that he thought he was. Even with his newfound fame, Defoe had to work hard and almost incessantly to promote his public identity as a respectable writer. He had to commission his own portrait for inclusion in the printed version of Jure Divino, and it's telling that this portrait was rarely reproduced. You can see it here. This is how, on the left side, Defoe as he wished to be seen, and on the right side, we see a crude broadside woodcut of Defoe as he was often seen by his enemies, stuck in the pillory. It's telling then that this this image was rarely reproduced. Quite the contrary, some readers seem to have taken delight in altering their copies of the tract by covering up the engraving of Defoe's portrait and adding or pasting in over it a rather different, crude, woodcut image of Defoe standing in the pillory. Now, Sacheverell, by contrast, had the security of his officially recognized status as an ordained clergyman and a doctor of divinity to support his claims to cultural authority. Sacheverell did not need to engage in self-promotion through print. He could rest content to let others do that for him, especially his favorite bookseller, Henry Clements. So during and after his trial, Sacheverell's portrait was put up for sale as a collective badge of Tory allegiance and association with what had now become a real cult of personality surrounding the doctor. So here we have the mezzotint image of Henry Sacheverell, which circulated throughout London in the later years of Queen Anne's reign. It was often owned by Tories who wanted to demonstrate their allegiance to the doctor. One broadside writer complained that he had met a cobbler who had spent the price of soling a pair of shoes on Sacheverell's portrait in mezzotinto, this portrait here. Sacheverell's portrait soon became ubiquitous in the outpouring of print related to the controversies provoked by his trial. His portrait was commonly affixed to Tory bindings of the official account of his trial, published by Jacob Tonson. Here you have that image, very often found bound up with these other accounts of Sacheverell's trial. It could be added to manuscript accounts of the trial, such as that of the Middlesex gentleman Charles Bird's case of Henry Sacheverell. And here we have a photograph of it from the Harvard Law School Library, where this Middlesex gentleman put together a manuscript account of Sacheverell's trial and pasted alongside it another portrait of Sacheverell. So for many works relating to Sacheverell's trial, the doctor's effigy would dominate the page and eclipse the text. We see that here with this large broadside, the life, character, and pious deportment of the Reverend Dr. Henry Sacheverell. And one of the striking things to my mind about this broadside is that his face dominates the whole broadside. The text is very, very tiny indeed. But the thing that immediately grabs the eye is this big image of Sacheverell's face. He must have been the most recognized person next to perhaps the Queen in Queen Anne's England. Here's another case, a very nice Dutch print, hand-colored and circulated. So Dutch artists were often being used to produce these very handsome images of Sacheverell's effigy. So Sacheverell's name and his effigy became associated with allegiance to the Tory cause. His image would be reproduced again and again. By the later years of Anne's reign, and even in the early Hanoverian age, Sacheverell had become a brand more so than a person. Taverns and other public houses put out shop signs with Sacheverell's head, and his effigy would even be painted on the sides of the Lord Mayor of London's coach. While such signs tended to function as a badge of Tory loyalty, they also attracted the attention of detractors. In the summer of 1711, three presumably Whiggishly inclined gentlemen, or so identified by their swords, would deface the Sacheverell's Head shop sign in St. Clementstane Parish, Westminster. Now, though this particular shop sign was deemed to be offensive by local magistrates after the Hanoverian secession, there's abundant evidence that other shops continued to use Dr. Sacheverell's Head as their identifying insignia well into the 1730s, and perhaps later. So Sacheverell did not have to make much of an effort to promote himself as a public figure. That work would be done for him by Tory partisans and other merchants and tradespeople who wished to cash in on the Sacheverell craze that had erupted in the wake of his sensational trial. For the doctor, what was so shocking about his public persona was that he rarely stuck to the script of what a clergyman should do in the normal course of his holy duties. His sermons were almost always politically charged, and they were so partisan as to be understood as political propaganda. Even his allies could find this a bit unseemly. The Archbishop of York, John Sharp, would judge the pulpit to be, of all places, the most improper for the publication or even suggestion of men's private sentiments concerning public affairs or state matters. So aside from delivering the firebrand sermons which made him famous, Sacheverell also dabbled in the Grub Street trade of pamphlet writing. One of his earliest forays into the world of print may have been the anonymously published work The Character of a Low Churchman, which was published in 1702 and was a reply to Richard West's, also anonymously published, The True Character of a Churchman of the same year. Sacheverell's authorship, however, was soon revealed, and the work would be widely republished in 1710 as booksellers from both sides of the political spectrum would try to cash in on anything Sacheverell-related. While Sacheverell was surely the best known as an incendiary high church preacher, even before he delivered his outrageous 5th of November sermon, Sacheverell's sermons were all known as newsworthy events. He was unafraid to dabble in the Grub Street propaganda that was Daniel Defoe's specialty. Sacheverell was not alone in this regard. Perhaps the most successful piece of high church propaganda was Francis Atterbury's anonymously published 1696 tract, A Letter to a Convocation Man, which set off the convocation controversy and spurred the growing calls for a new convocation of the clergy in Queen Anne's reign. So, despite their obvious differences, Defoe the Scribbler and Sacheverell the Doctor of Divinity could appear in similar ways in the polemic print culture of the early 18th century. The engraver George Bickham the Elder designed hostile effigies of both Sacheverell and Defoe that are remarkably similar. So here I've actually juxtaposed them together, in which on the one side you see the high church champion, the high church scribbler, if you will, of Henry Sacheverell, and on the other side, the Whigs medley with Daniel Defoe in the center, also playing a similar role. Now, in the first print, The High Church Champion, Henry Sacheverell is presented as penning his sermons with the guidance of the Pope and the devil. In the second print, The Whigs medley, Daniel Defoe is given the same treatment, although Oliver Cromwell is thrown in for good measure as well. So he's being advised by the devil and Oliver Cromwell there. The tract in Defoe's hand is entitled Resistance Lawful, a theme that he had emphasized often in both his journal, The Review, and in his poem, Jure Divino. At the very top, another effigy of Defoe in the pillory adds insult to injury. You can see there, Defoe is stuck at the top in the pillory. And the text reads, "What awkward, ill-looked fellow is this? He has an ugly, frightful phiz, and sure as black his conscience is, cadaverous, black, blue, and green, not fit in public to be seen, with dirt besmeared and goggle-eyed, with a long nose and mouth as wide, with blobber lips and lachrym jaws, warts, wrinkles, wens, and other flaws." It's worth remembering that Defoe now is a man in his 50s at this time. "With a nitty beard and a neck that's scabby, and an address that's very shabby, whose this I should be, I do not know, unless a Whig, I guess he's so. If I am right,
pray, take a throw.
And you know, the rhymes here, I mean, it's awful rhymes, very characteristic of poetry of the later Stuart period. But the rhyming of no, so, and throw at the end of this poem clearly is meant also to remind the reader of the name Defoe. And that would have been obvious to contemporary readers. So Defoe clearly had a harder time avoiding the sting of public derision through political libel in the early 18th century. Whereas his nemesis, Henry Sacheverell, turned his scourging into instant fame and additional wealth and power. After his conviction, he would gain an additional living at the town of Salatin in Shropshire, from which he would collect non-resident income, which was common for churchmen of the time, although still frowned upon. The bishopric that some of his Tory supporters had hoped for him would remain beyond his reach. Queen Anne would never have countenanced such a thing. But he did manage to receive a handsome promotion to the rectory of St. Andrew's Holborn, one of the wealthiest of London's parishes. And last but not least, he would marry, in good English fashion, a wealthy cousin who would establish his fortune on solid ground. By 1720, he had acquired a large house called The Grove in Highgate. This building actually still survives. It's currently owned by supermodel Kate Moss, and was also previously owned by Samuel Taylor Coleridge as well. So he did rather well for himself. Defoe, by contrast, struggled through the rest of his life and remained dependent upon his pen to maintain his precarious solvency. Not long after he died, his reputation would begin to fade quickly, and he suffered from the derision of Tory wits like Jonathan Swift or Alexander Pope. It was not until the enterprising late 18th century bookseller Francis Noble began to revive Defoe's reputation as a novelist, and in so doing he would attribute works like Roxana or Moll Flanders to him. So one of the frustrating aspects of Defoe's scholarship is that he published most of what he wrote anonymously, so we don't know in retrospect what he actually wrote. And some of the works that now we think of as quintessentially Defoe's, Robinson Crusoe, of course, we know he wrote that, but Roxana, the novel, or Moll Flanders, the novel, which are taught in English literature classes as novels of Defoe by many, many people, we actually don't know whether he wrote them or not. And so recent scholarship has certainly not de-attributed the novels, but it's called into question whether we could ever know. They were simply published as anonymous novels at the time. We desperately seem to want them to be by Defoe because it would make him into the great writer that we admire today, but we just don't know at all. So it's really not until the late 18th century that Defoe's reputation starts to become resuscitated, and it's a reputation that is resuscitated as a great man of English letters, as the inventor of the English novel. This came just at the time when Sacheverell's reputation was fading fast, and the controversies and furies aroused by Sacheverell's trial would begin to seem embarrassing to Britons of the Romantic era. So I think what we see here in their posthumous afterlife is a curious transformation in their reputational stock, if you will. Here we have a Victorian image, a very classic image of Daniel Defoe in the pillory, in which he is stuck there in the stocks, and the crowd is throwing flowers at him. And if you read Defoe biographies today, you'll often see authors referring to how the crowd was on Defoe's side when he was in the pillory, and that they adored him so much that instead of pelting him with tomatoes and rotten food, as was normally the case for a convicted criminal in the pillory, they threw flowers at him instead. I found no contemporary evidence that suggests that that actually happened. The closest evidence that we have for it is this Victorian image of Defoe. And so I think that actually that tells us something, that image of Defoe as the great English writer who is adored by the crowd is an invention, really, of the 19th and 20th centuries rather than of the 18th century. So, from this moment on, however, though, by the 19th century, Defoe would increasingly become seen as a true pioneer of English letters, the inventor of the English novel above all, and a champion of progressive values such as religious toleration and constitutional limits on royal absolutist pretensions. In the 19th century, the cult of Defoe would flourish. And this is exactly at the time when the cult of Sacheverell had almost completely disappeared. And if you look at 19th century references to Sacheverell, and indeed the Sacheverell prosecution and the trial, there's almost a bit of embarrassment about why people got so worked up about this crazy, hot-headed Tory clergyman. So the roles are reversed in the fullness of time, if you will, by the 19th century and certainly the 20th century. It was Defoe who would be the great hero of the age of Queen Anne and the one who had emerged triumphant in these paper wars, rather than Sacheverell, the man who actually did quite well for himself in his own lifetime and in the 18th century. So, in conclusion, I'd like to suggest that perhaps it was the scribbler who had the last laugh. Doing this, are we just right on time? Okay. Right. Right. Yeah. No, I had left that out of the bit. It's what Sacheverell had. I mean, he was gunning for controversy in many ways, and so he had made a name for himself throughout Anne's reign as this crazy, wild, but charismatic preacher who would get up into the pulpit and effectively claim that the Toleration Act of 1689, well, he couldn't deny that it was the law of the land because it had been passed by Parliament, but he could claim that it was sinful. And so that as a clergyman, he could say, well, yes, dissenters may have the legal right to worship in their meeting houses now, according to the 1689 Act, but that doesn't excuse them from the sin of schism, and that this is an abomination in the eyes of God. And he would go on and on about this, how the Protestant dissenters were sinners, they were abominations, and in fact, we really need to encourage them as best as possible to give up their religion and rejoin the Orthodox Church of England for the sake of their own souls, which was a common Tory line, and in fact had been used, that was the justification for persecuting Protestant dissenters before the Glorious Revolution. So Sacheverell is continuing to articulate a religiously motivated justification for persecution of Protestant dissenters. So he's doing that. He's also, to a certain degree, calling into question resistance theory, which is emerging in Queen Anne's reign as a justification for what had happened during the Glorious Revolution of 1688-89. That was the revolution, a revolution in which King William, William of Orange, had landed in the West Country of England with a massive Dutch army. And effectively invaded England and scared James, partly because James's army refused to fight for him and they abandoned him. And so James just left. He got out of the country and fled to France, thus creating a power vacuum which allowed for William of Orange to become crowned as king, joint king with his wife, Queen Mary. So that was the Glorious Revolution. And the Whigs later, I mean, in the immediate wake of the Glorious Revolution, they didn't want to, make a big deal out of the resistance that had been displayed at the Revolution because it was too controversial. But by the early 18th century, the Whigs were beginning to openly proclaim that this incident, the Glorious Revolution, demonstrates that the people have the right
to resist tyranny. King James was a Catholic tyrant. He had ruled, he had tried to impose popery, so they say, on his people. He had tried to run roughshod over the laws and establish constitution of the Kingdom of England, and that justified resistance by the people. And so that becomes part of the Whig mythology of the Revolution. And so Cheverell's saying, well, that's crazy. That is a sin, too. And so passive obedience was his doctrine. And so his sermons were preaching up the validity of passive obedience. In other words, that there is no reason why subjects of a lawful monarch should ever resist his his will, no matter what, even if they are against the laws of the kingdom. So it's quite controversial stuff that Sacheverell is preaching. And if you take it to an extreme conclusion, you could say what Sacheverell is doing is justifying things like persecuting dissenters, perhaps even harming them physically, certainly destroying their properties, and indeed that happens during his trial. London explodes in riots during the trial, actually, and these high church mobs feel that the trial has given them license to run rampant throughout the city, and they hunt down mainly Presbyterian meeting houses, and they burn them down, they tear them apart, they destroy them. It's real chaos. It takes the London trained band and the threat of calling in the army to finally stop these riots. So again, that's emphasizing my point that England at this point here during the age of the War of the Spanish Succession is on the brink of civil war in its own way. That the Sacheverell riots are a form of civil war. They're quickly suppressed, but there's a bubbling discontent that could easily spill over into violence at any moment here within the kingdom itself. So that's effectively what he does. And then the Whigs, obviously, he does this most provocatively in St. Paul's Cathedral on the 5th of November, 1709, which was the anniversary of King William's landing at Torbay, the anniversary of the Glorious Revolution, also the anniversary of the Gunpowder Plot. It was supposed to be a day when you preach up the importance of the Glorious Revolution and resistance to popery, and instead he does quite the exact opposite. So it's seen as intense insolent and desire and needing of punishment. So that was the controversy. Yeah, Jonathan.
So my question is about the representation of defunct body.
Uh-huh.
And it seems to me that you have a series of three papers that are all ostensibly about propaganda. And one of the ways that we often think about propaganda is it's what we use to manipulate people's minds and thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, do you want to?
First of all, second of all, you're making a speech. Could you get to the question?
I'll take my time to get to the question, thank you very much, because there's a point behind it, and I want to make clear what that point is, if you don't mind. So my question for you, Brian, would be that so many of the papers today are about propaganda as mind control, and what's been interesting is that so many of them also note, or will note, the ways that propaganda is not just about the control of minds, but about the control of bodies. And so what is interested in your presentation was the differing ways that Sacheverell and Defoe are displayed, right? I mean, it's only Defoe that we see in the pillory, isn't it?
Yeah, well, and Sacheverell is not pilloried.
Okay.
So that would have been really, I mean, that would have made him into even more of a martyr. To pillory a clergyman, you just don't do that.
Okay.
Yeah. But you could do that for a hacky scribbler like Defoe.
Thank you. Great. I think we have time for one more question.
Yeah.
We generally hold to the view that, or many hold to the view, that Britain got involved in the War of the Spanish Succession as a question of stopping French expansion and maintaining some balance of power in Europe, which again would be continuing and lead later on to the Seven Years' War. However, you seem to be suggesting that the government was more, was equally, if not more, concerned with domestic issues than they were with foreign policy. And so my question to you is, how did the, what role did the war play in terms of the very domestic politics?
What role did the war play in domestic
politics? Well, yeah, you're suggesting that there was preoccupation, that Britain was on the verge of civil war, and they were more concerned with the ramifications of the civil war and the Glorious Revolution and all those things, and that therefore one could take the attitude that the involvement in the War of Spanish Succession was just an instrumental way of somehow being concerned with domestic issues more than foreign issues. So what I'm asking is, in your analysis, what role would you assign that to this whole question of foreign policy and its, Britain's involvement in the War of the Spanish Succession?
Yeah, it was all sort of, I mean, it all comes together because there were a series of issues at play here. The Whig government, the government that is actually prosecuting Sacheverell, is also the government invested in prosecuting the war and is thought by the Tories and by Sacheverell supporters as being incredibly wasteful in so doing, and therefore that the war has now really gone too far. In fact, very little is to be gained from continuing the war. And so that, this is why foreign observers are particularly interested in what's going on during the trial, because they see that should Sacheverell emerge as a hero, should the Tories prevail from this event, that therefore that perhaps Britain will move swiftly to concluding a peace. And indeed, that's more or less what happens. The wake of the trial was that there was that the Queen withdraws her support from the Whig, the bellicose Whig government. She institutes a new administration. She calls a new Parliament in the autumn of 1710, one in which Tories are returned overwhelmingly. Actually, it's so that the government in Britain from 1710 to 1714 is a Tory one, and the immediate thing that the Tory government sets itself to do is to try to conclude a peace to the War of Spanish Succession. It takes them a while to do it. They don't finally get around to concluding the Peace of Utrecht until 1713. But many of the Whigs are clearly not in favor of this. Their rhetoric was no peace without Spain. They wanted to ensure that the war would result in severing the Bourbon accession to the throne of Spain and adding the and continuing Habsburg domination of Spain. That goal goes is thrown out with the Tory government. The Tories are willing to countenance a Bourbon accession as long as they can solve the war with France and to bring a conclusion to the war. So there are international ramifications to this, and that's why the issues being debated here are domestic ones. They're domestic ones about the treatment of Protestant dissenters, the nature of the Glorious Revolution. But the Glorious Revolution itself had brought Britain into international war with Louis XIV in the first place, and the War of the Spanish Succession was in many ways a conclusion of that. Certainly, there was also the worry about the what you might call the English succession or the British succession, because the Stuart dynasty was still waiting, perhaps, to make a bid for restoration. In fact, they tried an ill-fated attempt to invade Scotland in 1708. In 1715, there would be yet another attempted Jacobite restoration. So Britain itself is very unstable. The civil conflicts and the foreign conflicts are deeply interrelated throughout the reign.
I know that comparisons are over. I'm just wondering very quickly.
I'm sorry, we're out of time.
Okay.
Can you move on to the next speaker?
Okay.